From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Yeah, I'm disappointed. I'm not sure why that's happened. She talked to me after I made my statement, and I see she's finally calling for Secretary Rumsfeld's resignation. And I think, I don't know what the reason she's decided not to endorse my position.
Congressmember Jack Murtha on Hillary Rodham Clinton. Murtha was the first to rock the Democratic Party by calling for withdrawal from Iraq. Then a conversation with New York Congressmember Anthony Weiner, who authored the amendment outlawing the Palestinian UN mission to the United States.
Mahmoud Abbas does not represent, I hope he doesn't represent the PLO. He certainly doesn't say he does. He represents the Palestinian Authority. PLO is a terrorist organization. It's acknowledged as a terrorist organization by the U.S. State Department.
But the Congressmembers got it wrong on both counts. Abbas is the head of the PLO, and the PLO is not listed as a terrorist organization by the State Department. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As New Orleans marked the first anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, President Bush, for the first time, said he takes full responsibility for the government's highly criticized response to the crisis.
The challenge is not only to help rebuild, but the challenge is to help restore the soul. I take full responsibility for the federal government's response. And a year ago, I made a pledge that we will learn the lessons of Katrina and that we will do what it takes to help you recover.
President Bush says he would support legislation that would give Louisiana a higher share of offshore gas revenues, but did not say how much money he thinks should go to the state. Dozens of ceremonies were held Tuesday from the city's core to surrounding parishes. At 9:38 in the morning, Mayor Ray Nagin rang a bell to commemorate the time when the first levee broke a year ago.
As I look out among all of you, I know that there are some people out there that are having a difficult time with today. I am personally having a difficult time with it. But trust me that we will get through it. And we will get through it if we work together. There's never been a disaster like this in the history of this country. And we are hopeful that there will never be a disaster like this ever again.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan is in Israel today, where he continues his tour of the Middle East, appearing with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert in Jerusalem. Annan repeated his call for an end to Israel's blockade of Lebanon and said he expects to step up the UN peacekeeping force on the ground.
We have about 2,500 troops on the ground now, and we're going to try and double that number and get to 5,000 in the coming days and weeks. And I hope that as we do that, the Israeli withdrawal will continue. And by the time we are at that level, Israel would have fully withdrawn and we will have an effective, credible force on the ground that we can continue to build on.
In other news from the region, UNICEF says 12 Lebanese have been killed by unexploded cluster bombs since the ceasefire was reached earlier this month. The organization says the bombs remain a major threat to civilians, especially children. Lebanese officials have conducted a new aerial survey of the massive oil spill on Beirut's coastline. Up to 15,000 tons of oil spilled into the sea following Israel's bombing of a power plant at the outset of its attack on Lebanon. This is environmental expert Georges Peignet.
The object of the trip today was try to get additional data compared to what we already get yesterday with the first survey we did, for which we did not go further north than Tripoli. This is why we had to go up to the border. And what we have seen mainly is that there is no oil or quite no oil on the water at sea. All the oil which is there is on the coastline.
Lebanon was able to conduct the new survey only after receiving permission from Israel, which continues an air and sea blockade. In Britain, three more people have been charged in the alleged plot to blow up U.S.-bound airliners. 15 of 25 initial suspects have now been charged in the case. The Bush administration is facing new accusations of seeking regime change in Venezuela. Documents obtained by the Associated Press show the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, has given more than $26 million to opponents of President Hugo Chavez in the last 4 years. USAID released copies of more than 100 contracts with the groups, but hid the names of about half of them. Larry Burns, director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, said, quote, "This indicates there's a great deal of money, a great deal of concern to oust or neutralize Chavez. The U.S. is waging diplomatic warfare against Venezuela," he said. In the occupied territories, hundreds of Palestinian workers held demonstrations in both Gaza and the West Bank to protest unpaid wages. More than 160,000 Palestinian government employees have gone without salaries following a U.S. and European aid freeze on the Hamas-led government. This is Riad Awawi, a teacher in Ramallah.
We, the employees, are oppressed because we do not have any salaries. But at the same time, we do not want our government and our legislative council to give up its steadfastness. No to hunger, and no to kneeling, and no to sanctions. We want the world to hear our voices and tell them that we are being mistreated.
In Iran, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has issued a new challenge to President Bush, a televised debate. On Tuesday, Ahmadinejad said he would like to debate Bush about world affairs and the ways to solve them. He also defended Iran's right to nuclear energy.
Peaceful nuclear energy is the right of the Iranian nation. The Iranian nation has chosen that based upon international regulations, it wants to use it and no one can stop it.
The Iranian president's comments come ahead of the UN's deadline Thursday for Iran to suspend nuclear enrichment. The Security Council has threatened sanctions if Tehran fails to comply. In Iraq, at least 40 people are dead following bombing attacks across the country today. At least 24 people were killed when a roadside bomb exploded in Sirja, Baghdad's largest wholesale market. Another 35 people were wounded. In Hilla, an attacker posing as an army recruit set off a bicycle bomb, killing 12 people and wounding 28. Here in the United States, new figures show an increase in the number of Americans without health insurance and a virtually unchanged poverty rate. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, 1 in 8 Americans and almost 1 in 4 African Americans lived in poverty last year. It was the first year the poverty rate did not increase since President Bush took office. Just under 16% of the population, or 46.6 million people, had no health insurance last year, up slightly from 2 years ago. This news from the CIA leak case. The New York Times is reporting former Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage has admitted he was the White House source who outed former CIA operative Valerie Plame to columnist Robert Novak 3 years ago. This according to a lawyer involved in the case and several of Armitage's associates. More trouble for former Corporation of Public Broadcasting Chair Kenneth Tomlinson. The State Department has concluded Tomlinson committed several ethics violations in his current position, chairing the board that oversees most U.S. broadcasts to foreign countries. According to investigators, Tomlinson gave a friend a $250,000 in taxpayer-funded contracts, overbilled the government for his time, and used federal employees for his personal business. Among that personal business, running a stable of thoroughbred horses he named after leaders from Afghanistan, including President Hamid Karzai. This is only the latest scandal for the former Reader's Digest editor and longtime Republican. Tomlinson was forced out of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting last year after it was revealed he improperly tried to promote conservatives in the organization and monitored programs he accused of having a liberal bias. And finally, the great Egyptian author Naguib Mahfouz has died at the age of 94. He was one of the most celebrated writers in the Arab world and the first Arab to win the Nobel Prize in Literature. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, we begin with Iraq. Yesterday, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld likened critics of the war in Iraq to those who tried to appease Nazi Germany during the 1930s. In a speech to the American Legion Veterans Group in Salt Lake City, Rumsfeld referred to the period before World War II and said, quote, "Some seem not to have learned history's lessons. I recount that history because once again we face similar challenges in efforts to confront the rising threat of a new type of fascism." Rumsfeld also criticized a number of newspaper stories on abuses by U.S. troops and defended Guantanamo Bay, saying it's arguably the best run and most scrutinized detention facility ever. Well, on Tuesday, one of the leading critics of the war, conservative Democratic Congress member Jack Murtha came to New York to take part in a town hall meeting. Murtha's a decorated Army veteran with close ties to military commanders. He's also the top Democrat on the House Appropriations Defense Subcommittee. He voted for the Iraq invasion and has visited Iraq several times since the war began. Last November, Murtha ignited a firestorm in Washington when he called for an immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq and said he was wrong to endorse the invasion. I had a chance to question Congressmember Murtha yesterday.
Can you talk about your position in Iraq? What are you calling for right now, Congressman Murtha?
I believe we should redeploy responsibly as quickly as possible. I feel very strongly we can't desert Iraq, but we have to find a way to reduce our presence. We've actually become the enemy in some cases. When you look at what's happened with our troops occupying the country when they said we'd be liberators, some of the military things that we have to do as military and some of the enemies we've made, we really lost ground. The incidents are increasing rather than decreasing. We got 130,000 troops and we're spending $8 billion a month. And we need to reduce our presence and let the Iraqis take over.
Can you talk about Haditha and what happened there? You were the first congressman to talk about it.
Yeah, I support the military 100% unless they make a tragic mistake like that, which hurts the rest of the troops and hurts our nation.
And what do you know at this point of what happened there?
Well, I know that the NCIS, which is the Naval Justice System, endorsed what I said. They said that these people were killed unnecessarily, I'm looking forward to that thing being resolved. It should have been resolved much faster. If I hadn't spoken out, it wouldn't even have been investigated.
And the fact that they're bringing a libel suit against you, one of the soldiers, Wouterich, saying that you have slandered the soldiers for talking about Haditha?
Well, you can't let something like this be overcome. You can't let something not be investigated.
Your early call for withdrawal of troops from Iraq, which shocked a lot of people, a conservative Democrat that you are, the Vietnam veteran that you are. One of the leading Democrats is from here, New York, Hillary Rodham Clinton. She did not endorse that call.
Yeah, I'm disappointed. I'm not sure why that's happened. She talked to me after I made my statement, and I see she's finally calling for Secretary Rumsfeld's resignation. And I think, I don't know what the reason she's decided not to endorse my position, but we're spending $8 billion a month, $11 million an hour, and there's so many things we could do. We cannot solve these other domestic problems without redeploying. And with 130,000 troops there for 3.5 years, the incidents are getting worse.
What message would you have for the senator from New York right now?
Well, I think she has to look at this very carefully and decide. I think she ought to be out more in front. She's a leader in this country. She's a leading Democratic nominee, and I think she has to look at what I've been saying.
Pennsylvania Democratic Congressmember John Murtha. After I spoke with him, I talked to New York Democratic Congressmember Anthony Weiner. In May, Weiner successfully added an amendment to a House bill banning aid to the Palestinian Authority. The amendment would outlaw the Palestinian delegation at the United Nations and kick them out of the United States.
Called for the Palestinian delegation to the UN to pack their bags, or more specifically, to pack their little Palestinian terrorist bags.
Right. Yes.
Why?
Well, for the longest time, the PLO mission, PLO hasn't been an accepted voice of the Palestinians for the longest time. Congress has said very clearly back in the 1980s and as recently as the middle of the 1990s that they were not welcome here in the United States. And frankly, the PLO is an organization that frankly no longer seems to represent anyone, but they're still considered a terrorist organization by the U.S. government.
So would you call the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas a terrorist?
No.
And yet the people who are at the UN.
Not the mission of the Palestinian Authority. This is the PLO mission. Mahmoud Abbas does not represent, I hope he doesn't represent the PLO. He certainly doesn't say he does. He represents the Palestinian Authority. PLO is a terrorist organization. It's acknowledged as a terrorist organization by the U.S. State Department. And the only reason that they're still there is because a court ruled that they were an adjunct of the United Nations, and thus there are two conflicting laws that are in place about one that says the PLO has to leave the United States, and the other that says admissions to the United Nations may stay. And so, frankly, I think that what I tried to do with the amendment you're referring to is just clarify the PLO is not welcome in the United States, nor should they be.
They represent the Palestinian government. The Palestinian government is led, the president is Mahmoud Abbas.
Not true. The PLO mission, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, is a terrorist organization and has acknowledged that by the United States government. The Palestinian Authority, which is headed by Mahmoud Abbas, arguably that doesn't represent the Palestinian people anymore since the election either, but that's a whole different story. But the PLO is a terrorist organization, and I believe that they should lose their quasi-diplomatic status, as they no longer represent any of the Palestinians, and they are considered a terrorist organization.
Congressmember Anthony Weiner, he called for kicking the Palestinian delegation out of the United States. But is his information accurate? Not his point of view, just the facts. Norman Finkelstein joins us in our Firehouse studio, professor of political science at DePaul University in Chicago. His latest book is called Beyond Chutzpah, on the misuse of anti-Semitism and the abuse of history. The facts, Professor Finkelstein.
The facts can become a little technical because there are multiple organizations now operating in the occupied territories. But Mahmoud Abbas was the successor to Yasser Arafat when Arafat passed away, and he became the chairman of the PLO executive. So he's clearly a member of the PLO. That I don't think is a matter of dispute.
And the issue of the PLO being on the list of terrorist organizations.
I'll be as precise as I can. The PLO was on the State Department's list of terrorist organizations until 1988. In 1988, there were these famous words that George Shultz had made Arafat recite in public.
Secretary
of State George Shultz. And at that point, the PLO was removed from the list of terrorist organizations, and the United States openly had diplomatic relations, or openly was able to meet with the PLO. I'm sure your listeners will recall before then there was the incident with Andrew Young having met with the PLO when it was a terrorist officially a terrorist organization, but afterwards it was removed from the list.
So for almost 20 years it's been removed, and the PLO has had a mission to the United Nations.
Well, the PLO mission to the United Nations began, if my memory serves, in 1974. The PLO observer mission began at the UN. Some of your older listeners will recall that's when Arafat gave that famous speech at the United Nations, the gun or the olive branch. So the mission, I think, began in 1974. And right now, the PLO is pretty much considered an ally of the United States against Hamas. So it's kind of peculiar that Mr. Weiner should be venting his ire at the PLO. Mahmoud Abbas, the PLO, are considered U.S. allies. We work with Dahlan, who's the main PLO representative in Gaza. He heads up their security forces, works with the CIA, works with Israel. These are our people.
We're going to go to break, and then we're going to come back to the conversation with Congressmember Weiner. And then we're going to Lebanon to play comments of a member of parliament in Lebanon about whether Israel should be accused of war crimes. Finally, we'll speak with an Iranian dissident about the situation in Iran now, and particularly about U.S. policy. We're talking to Professor Norman Finkelstein of DePaul University. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with my conversation with New York Congressmember Anthony Weiner.
Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the New York Times has called for an investigation of Israel for the use of cluster bombs on Lebanon. What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, a lot of those organizations, Amnesty International in particular, has always had a bias against Israel. And frankly, I would argue that in many cases the New York Times has as well. You know, Israel didn't choose to have a war. Israel, this is not about land. The Hezbollah hasn't said we want this sliver of land. They've essentially crossed over an international border. They're an organization who their avowed purpose is to eliminate Israel. Frankly, they're the enemies of the United States as well. In times of war, bad things happen. And it is tragic when there is any innocent loss of life. But when Hezbollah chose to declare, essentially violate an international border, a UN-recognized border, a border that was agreed to by Israel and theoretically the nation of Lebanon, when they chose to invade Lebanon and essentially take over by creating a government within a government, they to some degree chose the war in Israel. You know, they're a sovereign state. They have to prosecute it the way they think it's best.
The U.S. government is now investigating whether Israel's use of cluster bombs violated their relationship with the United States in terms of getting cluster bomb technology. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I certainly think that the United States government should make sure that all laws were followed, but we mustn't lose sight of the forest for the trees. This was a horrible thing that happened. Why did it happen? It happened because the Iranians have armed Hezbollah to be a surrogate army for them, to essentially occupy the occupy Lebanese territory, to then invade Israel. None of these things were chosen by Israel, and Israel, frankly, has to be able to defend herself just like we do.
Last question. Sure. You think the New York Times is anti-Israel?
I think that there have been times it is that the New York Times has shown bias. But, you know, I've heard many of my friends who support the Palestinian position say the same thing about the New York Times on that side. So perhaps that's the definition of someone who's the middle ground. But I do think that there are, that the New York Times has shown a bias in its reporting.
That is New York Congressmember Anthony Weiner. Our guest is Norman Finkelstein, professor at DePaul University in Chicago, professor of political science, author of Beyond Chutzpah and the Misuse of Antisemitism and the Abuse of History. The issue of Human Rights Watch, I guess he's talking about Amnesty International and then to the New York Times of being anti-Israel.
Well, it depends on what standard you're using. Throughout most of the world, I think American media generally, and the New York Times in particular, are considered very pro-Israel. I suppose in certain extreme fanatical corners of the universe, they're considered anti-Israel. But if you look at, you know, you take an ordinary incident, and it's useful to look at ordinary incidents. Take the case in June of this year when there was the killing of the Palestinian family in Gaza Beach, and there was the famous scene of the 10-year-old girl wailing beside her father. And now there were two ways the story could have been reported. There was the official Israeli version. They claimed they had nothing to do with the killing of the family and the firing of the shell. And then you had the version of Human Rights Watch, which is one of the leading human rights organizations in the world. They sent over an expert to examine all the available evidence. He concluded the evidence was overwhelming that the Israeli government was responsible for the deaths of that family. What did the New York Times do? It reported the Israeli government version, then it reported the Human Rights Watch version, and then a few days later, the Human Rights version disappeared, and the New York Times stated that the deaths that occurred in Gaza Beach, we don't include as among those for whom Israel is responsible. Why? Because the Israeli government said it wasn't responsible. Now, that kind of reporting you haven't found in the United States since the days of the Daily Worker when it reported on the Stalin purge trials. To take the word of a government against the word of a human rights organization, and then to simply deposit the findings of the human rights organization in Orwell's memory hole. Human Rights Watch disappeared. Israel wasn't responsible. Why? Because the Israeli government said it wasn't responsible.
I wanted to go to this issue of criticizing organizations or people who criticize Israeli military policy, calling them anti-Israel, and then there's always the step beyond anti-Semitic. Your comment?
Well, first of all, it has a long history. Every time Israel comes under international pressure, as it did recently because of the war crimes committed in Lebanon, it steps up the claim of anti-Semitism, and all of Israel's critics are anti-Semitic. 1974, the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, puts out a book called The New Anti-Semitism. 1981, the Anti-Defamation League puts out a book, The New Anti-Semitism. And then again in 2000, Abraham Foxman and people like Phyllis Chesler, they put out these books called The New Anti-Semitism. So the use of the charge anti-Semitism is pretty conventional whenever Israel comes under attack. And frankly, it has no content whatsoever nowadays. If you open up like Phyllis Chesler's book, The New Anti-Semitism, she says Jewish feminists are anti-Semites, NPR is anti-Semitic, BBC is anti-Semitic, Los Angeles Times is anti-Semitic, New York Times is anti-Semitic, Washington Post is anti-Semitic, everybody's anti-Semitic. The term is devoid of any content. Anyone who ever criticizes Israel is anti-Semitic. What does the evidence show? There's been good investigation done, serious investigation. All the evidence shows there's no evidence at all for a rise of a new anti-Semitism, whether in Europe or in North America. The evidence is zero. And in fact, there's a new book put out by an Israel stalwart. His name is Walter LeCur, a very prominent scholar. It's called The Changing Face of Anti-Semitism. Just came out 2006 from Oxford University Press. He looks at the evidence and he says, no, there's some in Europe among the Muslim community, there's some anti-Semitism. But the notion that in the heart of European society or North American society, there's anti-Semitism is preposterous. And then, a significant rise in anti-Semitism is preposterous. The people who write this stuff, you know, you just quoted Mr. Weiner, that Mr. Abbas is not a member of the PLO. If you read these people, Phyllis Chesler, her book, The New Anti-Semitism, had lots of praise by serious intellectuals like Paul Berman. She keeps saying in the book that India is an Arab country. And she's very emphatic about this, that India is an Arab country. That's the level of intellectual, you know, debate and discussion in this country when it comes to the Arab world.
Didn't the ADL come out this week with a statement about Amnesty International?
Yeah, the ADL came out with a statement that Amnesty International is borderline anti-Semitic, and that's pretty conventional from the ADL, that these organizations are anti-Semitic, or then in other cases, they accuse individuals or organizations of being Holocaust deniers. None of this, first of all, as I said, it's pretty commonplace from these organizations. The Simon Wiesenthal Center recently issued a statement condemning the United Church of Christ for being not borderline anti-Semitic, but functionally anti-Semitic, because they oppose the wall that Israel is building in the occupied territories. Anyone who's a critic of Israel becomes an anti-Semite. And the truth of the matter is, the real anti-Semites, they don't really care about, or the real Holocaust deniers, which is their other favorite epithet to hurl at people, or expectorate at people who are critical of Israel. So you take the case, now there's a lot of discussion about the Iranian president's statements denying the Nazi Holocaust. Whether he actually did or not, literally, I'm not going to get into now. It's not so important. For argument's sake, let's say he did do it. He denied Nazi Holocaust. Now, you heard Mr. Weiner, he's very fond of Abbas. He says Abbas has nothing to do with the PLO. Now, you take Abbas. Abbas is an authentic Holocaust denier. He wrote his doctoral dissertation denying the Nazi Holocaust. He published it as a book in 1982. He said less than 1 million Jews were killed during World War II. He denied the Nazi gas chambers. Now, there you have a real Holocaust denier. You don't have to really probe the meaning of his words. It's pretty straightforward. Well, he's the American favorite now. Everybody loves Mr. Abbas because he does the American bidding. So they don't care that he's a Holocaust denier. Let me just give another pretty indicative example. Take the case of Ronald Reagan. Nowadays, many people are fond of Reagan. You listen to right-wing radio, which I listen to all the time, and you listen, everyone loves Reagan. Everybody forgets Reagan was the one who went to Bitburg, gave the speech saying that the Nazi soldiers, including the Waffen-SS, were victims just like the Jews in the concentration camps. That was his famous statement at Bitburg. The ADL, which claims to be so vigilant about Holocaust denial, the ADL gave him their Torch of Liberty Award. Then, just this past 2 years ago, Berlusconi, the president of Italy, former president of Italy, gave this speech praising Mussolini and saying all the charges against Mussolini were false. He's basically a good guy. 3 weeks after he gave his speech, and remember, Mussolini passed the anti-Semitic laws at the end of his regime, sent Jews to their death. 3 weeks after he gave his speech, the ADL, Anti-Defamation League, Abraham Foxman, who's now accusing Amnesty of borderline anti-Semitism, they gave him the Distinguished Statesman of the Year Award, had a big gala for him. And even, you know, fairly conservative economists like Robert Solow, Paul Samuelson, Modigliani, okay, they're not conservative by conventional standards, mainstream economists, they wrote a very irate letter to the New York Times. Why is the ADL giving this guy an award? Well, the answer was simple. Because at that point, he was the only European leader who was very pro, he was very pro-Israel. They don't care about Holocaust denial. They have no interest in it. Let me give you one example. One example just from what you were airing a moment ago. You heard the speech by Rumsfeld where he says that Iraq is like the Nazis in the 1930s. Now remember, the tenet of the Holocaust industry is never compare the Holocaust to anything else. Never compare. And if you compare, they say you're a Holocaust denier. But that side is always comparing. The Mufti of Jerusalem was Hitler, Nasser was Hitler, Saddam Hussein was Hitler, Hezbollah is now Hitler, Iran is Hitler, Hamas is Hitler, Iraq is Hitler. They're the worst Holocaust deniers in the world by their own definition. They're always comparing.
Norman Finkelstein, I want to thank you for being with us, professor of political science at DePaul University in Chicago. His new book is called Beyond Chutzpah, on the misuse of anti-Semitism and the abuse of history. As we turn now to the situation in Lebanon, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has rejected calls for a swift end to Israel's air and naval blockade of Lebanon. Speaking after talks with UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, Olmert said the seven-week siege would only be lifted once the ceasefire terms were fully implemented. Annan flew to Israel from a visit to Lebanon. He's described the continuing embargo as, quote, a humiliation and infringement on Lebanese sovereignty. Amnesty International cited the blockade in a recent report that accused Israel of committing war crimes in Lebanon. The report called for a UN investigation into whether Israel broke humanitarian law by targeting civilian infrastructure and the use of cluster bombs in the month-long war. Well, now the Lebanese government is considering possible legal procedures to sue Israel for war crimes and crimes against humanity. Lebanese parliament member Hassan Makaiber is leading the charge in the case. He's an attorney and a member of the Parliamentary Human Rights Committee. Democracy Now!'s Anna Nogueira caught up with him in Beirut.
My committee and myself are leading the coordination of many efforts within civil society, but also within the official bodies in Lebanon, mainly the Prosecutor General and the Minister of Justice, to prosecute the war crimes of Israel. And for some background, for many viewers of yours or many politicians or political analysts, war is a simple game of power. It's the rule of power. And we would like to see that change. Instead of the rule of power, we'd like to turn it into the power of rules. And the rules, in that sense, are the international rules that are set forth by the Geneva Conventions that put criteria and principles even for the worst actions which mankind can do, which are wars. Even wars must follow rules. And if you look at the events, if you look at the war of aggression that has been waged by Israel, you would see that almost every single one of these rules of war have been broken. And the violations of the Geneva Conventions are not simple matters to be brought into reports. These are grave violations of a huge magnitude that are considered by international law as war crimes, and these are extremely dangerous and must be looked at such by the international community. Whatever we're talking about are nothing else but actions that have led to more than 1,300 dead, the third of them being children, more than 4,000 wounded, 1 million Lebanese displaced, forcefully displaced by the Israeli army, the Israeli aggression. We have hundreds of bridges that have been destroyed, roads, infrastructure, homes. In excess of 14,000 homes were destroyed, leveled down to the ground. There has been an unimaginable aggression against civilians. Particularly now, we still see the wounds in cluster bombs that have littered civilian areas that also are in violation of international law. The list could be very long. However, for as much as some politicians and international diplomacy looks at the facts and try to reach a ceasefire, which we are seeking now and to are seeking to lift the blockade, we're also looking beyond that to the acts of war that have been caused and looking at making sure that there will be no impunity of Israel in any future action. It is important that the world looks at war actions as crimes. If you kill a man, you're brought to trial in a court of law. If you kill 1,000, this is considered a war. And 1,000 man and child and women dead are almost simple numbers that you are counted on TV programs. It's horrible. This is why I think myself and many of my colleagues, mostly lawyers, but also civil rights activists, are seeking first to investigate properly and in a manner that would be technically sound and could be accepted in a court of law, that would be credible in a court of law, whether in an international court or any domestic court that would have jurisdiction. We are collecting all the data that relate to these war crimes. We will make sure that Israeli war criminals, whether civilian leaders or military leaders, are brought to trial. It is not an easy task, because Israel has the fourth largest army in the world, and it has huge support within the world, but also and particularly within the United States. But this is politics. What is important in whatever we're trying to do is bring the attention back into the rules which no one, no warring faction should ever forget, that you need to protect the civilians. Civilians should be outside of the scope of any of the war games which politicians and warring players such as generals and the like are willing to rage for every or any reason that they can believe sound. We consider that the war of Israel is not in self-defense. It has become so disproportionate that it is a war of aggression on its own merit. It has caused so many casualties that these casualties amount to war crimes. No impunity means trying Israeli war criminals within the appropriate jurisdictions.
Can you explain a little bit which jurisdictions you're hoping to take Israel to court in and who you want to address these war crimes to, attribute them to?
It would depend on the jurisdiction. There is indeed the first possibility is for any injured person, any victim, can sue Israeli authorities, both individuals and the state of Israel, within national domestic laws whenever they have dual nationalities. And there have been many such casualties. A United Nations peacekeeper, a Canadian, was killed along with four others by the Israelis on the Lebanese-Israeli border for no reason. And unfortunately, this couldn't bring any action of the United Nations. And we know that the wife of this serviceman is suing now in Canada. We have several other cases of Lebanese Canadians Lebanese Americans, Lebanese French, Swiss, Italians, all these nationalities, Germans also have been hit. Brazilian Lebanese have been killed, Kuwaitis. All these nationalities, dual nationals, can sue within their own national jurisdiction. Now, you're talking about families that have been totally destroyed. Their houses, the full families sometimes, have been totally wiped out. So we're seeking to assist those families, both in collecting information and evidence, and in providing them for legal services. And many international human rights organizations have been offering these services. Domestic courts are one avenue for legal action. Another is the International Criminal Court, which has been recently established, that has come into operations only in the year 2002. Now, this international court has specific competence to try war crimes and war criminals. Only individuals can be tried by this international court, and we're pushing, myself and my colleagues, wishing that the Lebanese government submits to the jurisdiction of this court, although it had not ratified the Rome Treaty, which has established the International Criminal Court. The third court that could have jurisdiction is the International Court of Justice. However, this would also require that Israel accept the jurisdiction of this court, which we, for the time being, we do not expect forthcoming, as we see that for as much Israel has been evading any form of acceptance to its liability, it would keep on neglecting international law, neglecting its own responsibility under international law. So in all these forms now are under study. Nothing is definite yet, except that we are working effectively with civil society, Lebanese and international civil society organizations, at collecting data, establishing network of lawyers, and also making sure that the appropriate qualification of the war of Israel is done as war crimes.
If in the International Criminal Court you would have to take an individual, would it be Olmert?
Lebanese Parliament member Hassan Mokhaiber leading the charge to investigate Israel for human rights abuses. He was interviewed by Democracy Now's Anna Nagara in Beirut. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has issued a new challenge to President Bush, a televised debate. On Tuesday, Ahmadinejad said he would like to debate Bush about world affairs and the ways to solve them. Ahmadinejad's comments come ahead of the UN's deadline Thursday for Iran to suspend nuclear enrichment. The White House dismissed the idea of a debate, describing it as a diversion from concerns over Iran's nuclear program. Well, as Bush refused the Iranian president's invitation to a debate, today we turn to an Iranian dissident who refused Bush's invitation to the White House. Akbar Ghanji is a renowned Iranian activist and investigative journalist, recently visited Democracy Now!'s Firehouse studio in the midst of this month-long world tour to raise awareness about human rights violations in Iran. His visit came just months following his release from an Iranian jail where he was imprisoned for nearly 6 years, imprisoned and tortured. Akbar also used his time in the U.S. U.S. to speak out against human rights abuses in Iran. He took part in a three-day hunger strike outside the UN aimed at forcing the Iranian government to release political prisoners. But he also carried a message for the Bush administration. Yes, he declined that personal invitation to the White House to meet with top U.S. officials overseeing Iran policy. This is part two of our interview with Akbar Ghanji. I asked him why he declined the White House offer. Our conversation was translated by Hussein Kamali.
من همونطور که قبلا هم بهتون گفتم فکر نمی کنم که از این راه کمکی به جنبش دموکراسی خواهی ما بشه.
As I mentioned before, Amy, I don't think this can help in any way our democratic movement.
مسئله اولمون اینه که به کشورمون حمله نظامی نشه. ما جنگ نمی خواهیم.
Our first demand and our first concern is to make sure that there is not going to be a military invasion against our country. We do not want war.
من این حرفا رو میزنم و توسط شما و دیگر رسانه ها منتشر.
I say these things and I appreciate your making it available and broadcasting it.
اونها این سخنان رو میشنون.
They hear what I say and
اگه جدا معتقد به صلح باشن حمله ای صورت نخواهد گرفت.
And if they are really interested in peace, they will not invade.
در مذاکره شما باید یک چیزی بدید چیزی بگیرید.
Always in a negotiation there's a give and take.
من چیزی برای دادن ندارم.
And I have nothing to offer to the president.
یک روشن فکرم.
I'm an intellectual.
چه چیزی داره بده؟
What can I offer him?
مذاکره باید بین دولت ایران و دولت آمریکا صورت بگیره.
If there are negotiations, it must take place between the government of Iran and the government of the United States.
مذاکره باید کاملا شفاف و علنی باشه که منافع ملت ایران اونجا نابود نشه.
And it must be a transparent negotiation.
Are you concerned if Iran develops nuclear weapons?
من نگران هستم که ایران نیروی هسته‌ای اصلی هسته‌ای تولید بکنه.
من بیش از اون که نگران چنین مسئله باشم نگران تکرار حادثه فاجعه بار شبیه چرنوبیل برای مردم ایران هستم.
More than that, I'm concerned about the possibility of a disaster like what happened in Chernobyl.
چیزهایی که دولت ایران تهیه کرده در بازار سیاه و قاچاقی بوده.
What Iran has acquired has been through black market.
این پروژه معلوم نیست چقدر ایمنی داره.
And we don't know anything about the security and the safety of this project.
انفجاری اونجا صورت بگیره طبیعت ما زیست بوم ما نابود میشه و انسان‌های ما اونجا نابود خواهد شد.
Should there be an explosion, should there be a catastrophe, the environment, the ecosystem and the people will be destroyed.
غرب نیست که با خطر بمب اتمی ایران مواجهه. این ما ایرانی‌ها هستیم که با فاجعه شبیه چرنوبیل ممکنه مواجه بشیم.
It's not the West that is confronted with the possibility of a nuclear Iran and Iran armed with a nuclear weapon, but it's the people of Iran faced with the potential disaster like Chernobyl.
در این حال سیاست غرب در این زمینه کاملا دوگانه است.
And also I should say that the policies of the West in this regard are fundamentally a dual standard.
در حالی که بمب‌های اتمی اسرائیل، پاکستان، هند و دیگر کشوران نادیده گرفته میشه، به ایران میگن شما حق غنی‌سازی هم ندارید.
They disregard the atomic weapons, atomic bombs available to Israel, Pakistan and India, but Iran is said not to have the right to enrich uranium.
البته من سیاست دولت جمهوری اسلامی رو نابخردانه میدونم.
Of course I find the policies of the Islamic Republic fundamentally unwise.
شعار ما باید خلع سلاح جهانی باشه.
We should strive to disarm internationally for an international disarmament.
ما باید با ملیتاریزه کردن جهان مبارزه بکنیم.
We have to fight the militarization of the world.
Is there a country, Akbar Ghanji, that you think is dealing with Iran correctly in a constructive way?
سازنده با ایران برخورد بکنه. کشوری هست وجود داره.
اون مسئله یک مسئله سیاسیه که باید مستقلن راجع به روابط دولت ایران و دولت‌های غربی صحبت بشه.
Well, that's another issue to talk about the government of Iran vis-a-vis Western governments.
هر دو طرف خطا کردن تو این مسئله.
Both sides are at fault in this issue.
دولت ایران با سیاست‌های غلط باعث این شده که اجماع جهانی علیه شکل بگیره.
The Iranian regime by adopting wrong policies has created a consensus against itself.
تو مسئله عراق شما می‌دونید که بین اروپا و آمریکا شکاف افتاد.
You know that there was a disagreement, fundamental chasm between Europe and the United States over the question of Iraq.
ولی تو این مسئله با حرفای سخنان نابخردانه‌ای که دولت ما گفته اجماع جهانی علیه ایران شکل گرفته.
But in Iran, because of the unwise positions taken by our government, there is an international consensus against us.
از طرف دیگه نگرانی بسیاری از مردم ایران اینه که به هر بهونه واهی میخوان ایران رو بزنن.
On the other hand, the fear, the concern is there with the Iranian people that the West is just looking for a false reason to invade Iran anyway, regardless of what they do.
ما تنها راهی که به نظرمون میرسه اینه که بین طرفین گفتگوی علنی و شفاف صورت بگیره.
The best way we can think of to stop this is to promote and to call for a direct negotiation,
گفتگو
and transparent negotiation between the two sides.
و دوری از جنگ.
Negotiations about peace.
و مسئله ما مسئله نقض حقوق بشر و دموکراسیه.
Our concern is about the violation of human rights and the establishment of democracy.
You were arrested in Iran. You had exposed during the Khamenei regime the killings of many dissidents. You were held for 6 years. Were you tortured in prison? Just recently released.
برخوردهایی که با بنده شد برخوردهای بسیار بدی بود.
I was gravely mistreated.
ولی مسئله من نیست. مسئله ده‌ها و صدها زندانی هستن که بدترین بلاها سرشون
اومده. But it's not only me. It's a matter of dozens, scores of prisoners who are treated in the worst conceivable way.
من همیشه سعی کردم صدای اونا رو به گوش جمع کنم.
I have always tried to be their voice.
به هر حال من از این شانس برخوردار بودم که تمام دنیا منو می‌شناسن.
I was lucky enough to be well known in the world.
ما بسیاری از افراد تو زندان‌ها داریم که حتی هیچ کس حتی تو داخل کشور اسم اینها رو نمی‌دونه.
However, there are numerous people in prison in Iran, but their names are unknown even to the people in Iran, within Iran.
بدون دلیل در سلول‌های انفرادی هستن.
They are kept in solitary confinement on no grounds.
بدون کتاب، روزنامه،
no access to books, newspapers or telephone.
بدون ملاقات، بدون وکیل.
No attorney present, no legal representation.
بدون ملاقات با خانواده.
And they are deprived of meeting with their families.
تحت فشار میذارنشون که اعتراف کنن ما جاسوسی کردیم.
And they are under pressure to confess to charges of espionage.
شوهای تلویزیونی اینا میگیرن که پشت تلویزیون مثل دوران استالین اینا رو بی‌آبرو کنن.
They bring them in front of camera in the same way that Stalin used to do and make them confess.
بر اساس همین شوهای تلویزیون ما رو محکوم میکنن به زندان.
And they will convict them to prison, sentence them, give them sentences based on those television shows.
کل این فرایند ما اعتراض داریم.
We object to this process.
Do they broadcast these so-called confessions on television in Iran?
پخش میکنن.
بله پخش میکنن.
Yes, they do.
یکی از شیوه ها همینه که افراد میبرن تو زندان کتکشون میزنن مجبور میکنن بیان پشت تلویزیون به اعتراف بکنن به جرم های ناکرده.
Yes, they beat them up in prison and then bring them in front of camera and they confess to crimes they have never committed.
Akbar Ganji, were you beaten up?
شما هم کتک زدن.
من هم چنین مشکلاتی داشتم.
I had similar problems.
Did they broadcast your so-called confession?
آیا شوی شما رو پخش کردن؟ از شما
من زیر باره هیچ شویی نرفتم.
I never went to any show.
هیچگاه من از مغازه خودم عقب نشینی نکردم.
I never withdrew my position.
مغازه‌ای که من تو زندان اتخاذ کردم بسیار رادیکال تر از مغازه قبل از زندانم.
My positions that I advocated from prison were far more radical from what I had said before going to prison.
سخت‌تر کردم منم مغازم رادیکال تر شد.
The harsher they treated me, I became more radicalized.
ولی من از هیچ کس دلخور نیستم و هیچ کس مسئله شخصی
ندارم. But I have no personal problems with anyone and I have no personal complaints.
مسئله ما دموکراسی و حقوق بشر و آزادیه.
Our problem is democracy. Our concern is democracy, human rights and freedom in the country.
Can you, Akbar Ganji, give us the landscape of the pro-democracy movement in Iran? Who makes it up?
چه کسانی چه عناصری در این دخیل؟
اولا ما در درجه اول یک طبقه گسترده روشنفکری بسیار قوی داریم.
First of all, we have a strong class of intellectuals.
این روشنفکرای قوی ما خواهان دموکراسی هستند.
And our intellectuals, this strong class, demands democracy.
در درجه دوم با نسل جوانی روبرو هستیم که ساخت جمعیتی ما جوانه و اینا خواهان تغییرند.
Secondly, we have a large younger generation and the structure of the population in Iran has a large youth population and that part of the population, that segment of the population wants democracy.
نصف از جمعیت کشور ما زنان هستن و اینا بهشون ظلم زیاد میشه و اینا هم خواهان برابری حقوقی با مردان هستن.
Half of the population composed by women also advocates and demands freedom and equality, legal equality with men, with the other half.
اقلیت‌های قومی زبانی از حقوق خودشون محرومن و خواهان حقوق برابر با دیگر اقوام هستن.
Ethnic and linguistic minorities are deprived of their rights and they demand equality with other groups.
اقلیت‌های دینی از حقوق خودشون محرومن و خواهان حقوق برابر هستن.
Religious minorities are deprived of their rights and they demand equality.
بنیاد دموکراسی و بنیاد حقوق بشر برابریه.
The foundation of democracy, of course, is equality.
ما جنبش‌های مختلفی داریم که همه خواهان برابری و آزادی هستند.
We have several different currents and movements in Iran, but all agree on the demand for democracy.
There are also those, for example, who are calling for the return of the Shah, or you know, like the son of the Shah, who would be opposed to this government.
رژیم فعلی مخالفن نظر شما راجع به
اینها بیشتر تو خارج و خصوصا در ایالات متحده آمریکا زندگی میکنن.
This group mostly is based outside Iran and mostly within in the United States.
اینا سالهاست از ایران دورن و هیچ نسبتی با مسائل ایران ندارن.
And they've been away from Iran for too long, way too long, and they don't keep in touch with what is going on in Iran.
سال گذشته نیروهای زیادی به زندان رفتن و کشته شدن ولی یکی از اونها نبوده.
Over the past 27 years, so many people have been imprisoned and suffered, but none of this group.
ضمن اینکه ما خواهان برابری هستیم.
Of course, we demand equality.
با تبعیض و حق ویژه مخالفیم.
And we oppose any form of discrimination and special privileges.
رژیم فعلی میگه حکومت حق ویژه فقهاست.
The current regime says it is the prerogative and the privilege of the clerics to rule.
در سلطنت طلبان میگن حکومت حق ویژه ی خاندانه.
And the monarchists advocate the right of a single family.
و این با دموکراسی تعارض داره.
This is in violation of democracy.
How did Ahmadinejad get elected?
Ahmadinejad چطور شد که انتخاب شد؟
این حداقل 8 دلیل داره.
At least there are 8 reasons, 8 causes for this.
اولین دلیلش این بود که کسانی مثل من انتخابات رو تحریم کردن.
First was that many people including myself banned participation in the election.
با این تحریم اون کسانی که به اصلاح طلب رای میدادن میلیون ها نفر ما خارج کردیم از انتخابات.
Therefore, by doing this, we withdrew millions of people who would have otherwise voted for the reformists.
Why were you banned?
چرا شما مخالفت کردید؟ تحریم کردید؟
برای اینکه شرکت در انتخابات یعنی همکاری با رژیم خودکامه و مشروعیت بخشی به اون.
Because participation in the elections is collaborating, it's a form of collaboration with the regime and legitimizing the activities of the regime.
نتیجه حتی اگه ما پیروز هم می‌شدیم نتیجه‌ای نداشت.
And even if we were to succeed in the elections,
there would be
futile, just as we saw in the 8 years of the reform movement.
دومین دلیل پیروزی احمدی‌نژاد این بود که اصلاح طلبان در دوره 8 ساله حکومتشون بسیار بد عمل کردند.
The second reason for the election of Ahmadinejad is the poor performance of the reformists over the 8 years of their tenure.
مردم در خوشبینانه‌ترین میگن اصلاح طلبان بی‌ارزن، در بدبینانه‌ترین میگن خائنن.
In the best case, the people say the reformists were incompetent. In the worst case, they say they were traitors. And they betrayed us.
سومین دلیل شکست اصلاح طلبان این بود که اینا نتونستن اجماع کنن بر سر یک نفر به عنوان کاندیدای ریاست جمهوری.
The third reason the reformists were defeated was that they could not agree on one candidate to run.
چهارمین مشکل این بودش که مردم جامعه ما به شدت به هاشمی رفسنجانی معترضن و اونو نماد فساد میدونن.
And the fourth problem, the fourth reason was that the people at large are highly suspicious of Hashemi Rafsanjani and
just an excerpt of our conversation with Akbar Ganji, renowned Iranian activist and investigative journalist, imprisoned by Iran for 6 years and tortured, says U.S. military action against Iran would only strengthen Ahmadinejad, the Iranian president's hand. Tomorrow, Iran faces a UN deadline to suspend nuclear enrichment. That does it for our broadcast. You can hear part one of our interview on our website, democracynow.org. This weekend, we go to Provincetown, Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard. We have a major event in New York. I encourage people to check our website for our Breaking the Sound Barrier tour. Democracy Now! Produced by Shrupa to Produce and John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.